Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia-Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The Pacific director of the Australian think tank, the Lowy Institute, Jonathan Pryke, was in New Zealand to launch the body's Pacific Aid Map. The map is an analytical tool designed to improve aid effectiveness in the Pacific by shining light on who is contributing what funds and where the money is going. And while he is there, he also was discussing concerns over growing Chinese influence in the Pacific. Don Wiseman asked Mr. Pryke about the apparent hysteria in Canberra and Wellington about the growing Chinese presence in the Pacific.
Well, I certainly think politics is getting a bit ahead of policy here. We've just had so many announcements coming out of Australia, New Zealand, the United States and Japan in the region that it's really going to be difficult for us to effectively follow through on all these major commitments we've now made to the Pacific region, which is being driven by this anxiety we now have about China's presence in the region. Is it hysteric? Well, certainly you can see the political urgency in the Pacific, particularly from Australia for the first time in a long time. I try to look at the silver lining of this. This political urgency is leading to a lot of change and a lot of shakeup in what we're doing in the Pacific and how much energy we're putting on the Pacific region. But I think a lot of the concerns we have about China, the anxiety we have about what China's doing, is probably a bit overstated. And the major concern is, of course, on the strategic front, that China is potentially looking to set up some form of military presence in the Pacific. I think that's all a bit overblown because we just don't fully appreciate the sovereignty of these countries and that they have their own agency and no one is interested in setting up some sort of military presence like that. But I think this is just us trying to ensure against that in any way we can. It's not a time for us to be sitting idle, and we're clearly following through on our commitments now to be stepping up. So I mean, I try to see the silver lining in all of this. I wish we wouldn't be pushed into it because of this sort of area, but overall I think it could be a very positive outcome for the Pacific.
When it comes to sovereignty, a lot of these Pacific countries, they have significant debts. Take Tonga, for example, a major debt owed to China. China has deferred it for 5 years, and Tonga's very grateful, but there's also, it's like a sword of Damocles, isn't it, above the government, and there are similar sorts of positions around the Pacific where it looks like China is holding all the cards.
Yeah, look, I don't buy into this whole debt trap diplomacy narrative. It's true that a lot of these countries, because of their small size, they don't have very big debt thresholds, and a lot of them are approaching their debt limits. But it's not just being driven by China. The World Bank, Asian Development Bank, Japan, they're all in the mix in these countries. And yeah, it just takes a few projects to really get you to your limits because they are quite small. These countries don't grow very fast. But it is also true that China does hold a significant piece of economic leverage in the debt that is now owed to these countries. But I think the Pacific has really wisened up to this. There have not been any new loans to any country in the Pacific bar PNG and very recently Vanuatu since 2016. There's much less appetite in these Pacific countries for more of the same, for more Chinese debt for large infrastructure projects, because now they realize that they are having to pay them back. And they're starting to look at the quality of the infrastructure and just, you know, a little bit more seriously at these big projects. So the Pacific is wising up to this.
Are the Pacific countries playing these big powers effectively off against each other?
Well, I think we are seeing part of that. Whilst there is, of course, great concern in Australia, New Zealand and others about the geostrategic issues in the region, the concerns for Pacific countries themselves is more about development. So for them, more competition in the region, for them, is just more options, more opportunities. So I think they are playing us off. Countries are all former colonies. They have a lot of experience in this. So, yeah, I think, you know, for them, it's a good thing that they have more opportunities.
Now, China has spent a lot of money on infrastructure, and now Australia, New Zealand, the US, also talking about significant infrastructure spending. But is that the right way? Should their money be going in different directions?
Yeah, I'm very cautious about the approach we are now taking by going full throttle into the infrastructure space in the Pacific. The reality is we don't have the skills. We have outsourced these skills for a long time to the World Bank and Asian Development Bank and instead focused on soft skills and infrastructure and working around governance of these sectors. I think now is the time to be continuing that focus, to be investing in the long run. Going full bore into infrastructure seems to me that we're just really following the leader with China here, as China is getting less appetite from these countries for doing infrastructure themselves. So it's going to be hard for us to do for a start. As I said, a lot of these countries are approaching their debt thresholds. We're going to have to be creative in how we finance these projects. I think we'll have to do a lot with private sector investment and superannuation funds, trust funds, providence funds and the like to try and get these projects off the ground. But we're also going to need to staff up to actually have the expertise to be able to do this effectively.
American researchers say there is less time than previously thought to try to address the effects of climate change. The fourth U.S. National Climate Assessment, released at the weekend, is federally sanctioned work of about 300 academics and experts on the threat posed to the U.S. by climate change. The assessment devotes a chapter to the U.S. Pacific, and Zina Grenchi from Honolulu-based West Wing Center says it means comprehensive freshwater systems, the destruction of the coastal infrastructure and coral reefs, and the great stresses on the region's biodiversity. She says in the 4 years since the last report, the threats of climate change have increased substantially.
Especially with sea level rise, it's accelerated and is now actually beginning to damage beaches, ecosystems, infrastructure like roadways and airports and housing. And the projections have been continually revised to be more severe and more quick in terms of the impacts hitting our island.
What would you say were the most affected parts of the U.S.-affiliated Pacific?
Yeah, well, it's clear that on low-lying islands like atolls, such as in the Marshall Islands, they will be feeling these impacts very strongly, probably before 2050, because they're low-lying and all of their infrastructure is just a few feet above sea level in a lot of places. There will be extended flooding, land and roadways and airports. Freshwater supplies will be damaged. And I think the freshwater is really an important thing to keep in mind for these islands because most only rely on rainwater and catchment of that rainwater for household and drinking use. And so even if it's possible to live through the floods and to rebuild or protect your home through adaptation, continually having a source of fresh water that's not inundated by salt water constantly may be a real challenge.
Does the report make any suggestions in terms of what people can do? I realize that across the Pacific, everyone is pretty well aware of climate change and is making efforts to do what they can to combat it, but is there more that can be done?
Yeah, well, the main objective of the report as a whole is to help people better identify, avoid climate-related risks. So the National Climate Assessment process does focus on what people are doing, and it assesses any published literature found in articles, reports, books that would support what are effective measures that people have been taking, especially those that have already had some success or been evaluated in some way. And so one of the ways that the report showcases those examples of successful adaptation or preparation for climate risk is in case studies. So these are stories about decision makers or community groups, people that are getting together to work on solving climate-related problems in their communities.
Now, the report covers the wider U.S., and some of the conclusions reached are very dramatic, with suggestion of temperature rise as high as 12 degrees by 2100 in parts of the U.S. But the U.S. is also a country with many climate skeptics, not least the president. So do you think you'll win over any of them with this report?
You know, I don't know that we'll win over anyone who outright denies the scientific consensus that climate change is happening and that it's dangerous and that we're already seeing impacts. But we know that, especially with the California wildfires and recent storms that have affected or threatened places in the United States, including terrible storms like in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands and in our Pacific Islands, we know that it will continue to be more and more difficult to deny, like I said, the scientific consensus around this. And whether or not people explicitly recognize that, decision makers explicitly recognize that in their comments, I think that this document can help them prepare regardless of what they're saying. They can prepare at least for the worst impacts on U.S. communities.
Police in Papua New Guinea's Enga province say tribal violence has escalated to humanitarian crisis. At least seven people were killed in shootouts and revenge killings between two tribes in Enga last week. Although the conflict has subsided, thousands of residents have fled there after their homes were burned down. Mackenzie Smith reports.
Police say the trouble started early last week with a drunken brawl in a club near the Porgera gold mine in Enga. Fighting between the Kandep and Paela tribes sharply escalated to a shootout where two people were killed. Local police commander Joseph Tondop says a retaliatory attack the same day killed two more.
It's just too many deaths and injuries and destruction of properties, not only in Pogra, but it extended all the way down the highway down to Layagam. And we had a ambush. In the ambush the next day, three people died.
Mr. Tondop says many more were injured, but it's too early to tell the extent of the damage because a police investigation is ongoing.
Most of the people who are involved actually are traumatized. They're not really available to give any statements, so we are in the process of investigating it now.
What is known is the fighting has uprooted entire communities in Enga. Mr. Tondop says around 3,000 people had their homes burned down and have been forced to flee. He says most of these people were illegal miners living near the Porgera mine in temporary settlements.
Because there are many people involved, it's like a humanitarian crisis now, so we are in the process of getting them evacuated or repatriated back to their provinces of Kapro.
Mr. Tondop says the situation in Enga is back to normal this week and roads are clear. No arrests have been made so far, with police waiting on the outcome of the investigation. Local media report that police are appealing to local leaders to surrender suspects. This is Mackenzie Smith.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Unemployment, teen pregnancy, and drug and alcohol abuse were some of the main concerns raised by youth in Solomon Islands during a recent UN peacebuilding forum. More than 200 young men and women from across the Western and Chulseo provinces met in Ginzo last week to talk about their challenges and hear about and discuss ways to overcome them. The three-day forum is part of the UN peacebuilding project that was hosted in the collaboration with the UN Women and Youth Departments of both local, provincial, and national governments. Kaori Hawkins spoke to the UN Peacebuilding Forum project manager Tony Cameron about the initiative.
The project idea was to enable the youth to come forward with ideas for peacebuilding through social entrepreneurship. So they come forward with innovation through this innovation forum to encourage young people to have civic engagement on various levels. It could be as simple as collecting rubbish, or it could be as advanced as, you know, starting a tourism kind of a business. So we have, I think, about 17 to 20, actually, young people presenting their ideas for social entrepreneurship through business ideas. And these are presented to a group of specialists, local Solomon Islanders who had already had some business initiatives underway. And they judged these particular initiatives to see how how effective they would be, and we came up with three winners, which sort of met all the different criteria, and those winners were provided with some small kind of business starting grant. They were given some mobile phones from the local telecommunications company here, and also provided some business training through a local business training facility.
We'll come back to those again, but just why is peace building necessary in Solomon Islands, and why are youth a particular focus?
Sure. Well, you may know that there were some, they're called the tensions here in the Solomons in the early 2000s, where a number of interethnic clashes were felt here in Honiara, the capital, and also in other provinces such as Malaita, which resulted in the Ramsey intervention, with New Zealand, of course, being one of those police contingents to come and stabilise the country. So the country had gone through a few years of conflict, partly ethnic conflict. And also there was, you know, an element of dissatisfaction with the governance systems here too. Since Ramsey has withdrawn, I think 2 years ago, the United Nations has kind of stepped up and has been trying to consolidate the peace process. And there are a few areas which are of concern. And one of them is, of course, the Western Province in Choiseul, which is bordering Bougainville, and that has, of course, a history of conflict through the Bougainville crisis in the 1990s. So essentially, this is why we're trying to consolidate the peace, which now exists, so we don't start slipping back into ethnic tensions and socioeconomic disparities, which also are a driver of conflict. So Western Province is one of the provinces which we've got an eye on and which we're trying to support and build social cohesion through supporting at-risk groups such as youth, who are the demographic which are far more likely to engage in conflict than any other.
And assuming the youth shared some of their views at this forum, what were some of the thoughts and thinking that came through?
Sure. Well, of course, there's a lot of frustration with youth in terms of lack of employment opportunities, which is, of course, quite common in remote island regions, especially in the West. Although the West is quite well endowed with, beautiful sort of scenery, aquatic life, and there is a sort of a rudimentary tourism industry happening there. So, they've got the natural resources to actually have some, interesting kind of initiatives and sort of job creation programs. The other concerns that youth raised were teenage pregnancies. This is indeed on the rise, especially school-age girls who, when they're pregnant, it's not exactly policy, but it's a given that if a young lady becomes pregnant while attending school, she has to drop out of school. The government's trying to change that pattern, but this happens to be the case. There's also things like drug abuse, marijuana, and other harder drugs, which are available, through the very porous border which exists between Solomons and Papua New Guinea. Another big one, of course, is environmental degradation through, the disposal of plastics and other toxic waste into the beautiful environment we have here. So these are some of the things which were raised by the youth themselves.
Now, apart from the prizes that we're giving out, is there going to be any follow-up to this?
Absolutely, yeah. So we're basically doing region by region or province by province. We covered Malaita province, I think in September recently, the same kind of process. So we're looking to engage these motivated young people to be advocates and spokespeople for their demographic group, to ensure that they are heard in the decision-making levels at provincial and national level.
Academics have been urged to ensure that cultures in the Pacific peoples are promoted within the educational system. Victoria University academic Kabini Sanga says schools who attended the Oceania Comparative and International Education Society annual conference in Wellington this week can work together to achieve this. Christina Rovi has more.
Dr. Sanga is concerned that school children in the Pacific have the view that they can't progress in the education system.
The cultures of peoples of the Pacific are not featured very well within education, within schooling systems. And children of the Pacific who go to school, even within Pacific countries, do not necessarily see themselves as people who are of place and culture to be intentionally developed by the education system.
Dr. Sanga says one of the problems facing Pacific Islanders is that they are missing out on some of the educational opportunities that developed countries offer their citizens.
You have parts of the Pacific where not all our children are going to school. You have parts of the Pacific where members of our communities who are not as able, whether it's physical or psychological or mental, don't have the same chances as others of us to have access to educational opportunities. And so variations of that nature continue to plague many of our Pacific countries and many of our Pacific peoples are missing out on some of the educational opportunities that the modern state might offer to its citizens. So that is a key issue, and it's an issue that a society like this continues to look at.
Hawaiian-based Fijian academic Vilsoni Haraniko, the guest speaker, urged delegates to work together to find solutions to issues affecting education in the region. He emphasized the need to reflect on the gains, challenges and possibilities of these changing times.
We could all collaborate, network, focus on, say, relationships amongst people, departments, programs, etc., in order to find solutions to problems we face, whether it's in education or in real life, you know, big issues like climate change or racial prejudice.
University of Papua New Guinea academic Anna Joskin says the industry is facing many challenges because classroom practices, including teacher views and interactions with students, have changed. Dr. Joskin, who is working on a paper on educational change in relation to professional development, says her study is centered on a mandated reform in PNG of the curriculum model and English language teaching. She says the study will also help academics support government policies.
I developed a model that came out of it from my data about how we can support whatever policy intentions the governance level directs. And I'm mindful of that because students come through the lower system in Papua New Guinea, primary system, to the secondary system, and they come to the university.
The growing demographic of New Zealand's Pacific population is changing the definition of cultural competency in the workforce, according to a Tongan psychiatrist. Dr. Celia Alakozalafoki has spent 20 years working in the mental health sector and says while there is now a record number of Pacific workers, the Pacific is not enough. The government figures show that 62% of Pacific Islanders are now born in New Zealand, and a growing number of them are of mixed descent. He spoke to Indira Stewart at a recent Pacifica Medical Association conference.
Cultural competency is really having to address a change in our own community. So there was a time, say, 20 years ago, when the majority of the Pacific community were actually island-born. So, and then it went through a period where it was kind of 50-50, but at the moment it stands 60-40. So 60% of all Pacific Islanders now are born in New Zealand. And the critical factor is two-thirds of all of those children are of mixed marriages, mixed heritage. So they're Māori Samoan, they're Tongan, Niuean. And so we have to think about, the term now is not about cultural competency, it's polycultural competency. We have to be competent across multiple cultures and intergenerational differences between what it means the value system of our island-born, more elderly community and the New Zealand-born value system, which is significantly different.
In your experience, what are some of those differences that stand out between a Niuean family, servicing a Niuean family and servicing a Tongan or Samoan family?
Yeah, the way I would describe it is that I had to go to there was a completed suicide in South Auckland, Tongan family and Cook Island family. And the distress of a suicide, the tragedy of it, often we come together and we have our cultural protocols that help us with our grief. And one of the really complicated things was seeing the conflict between the Cook Island family and the way they wanted to address the grief and the way that the Tongan community wanted to address their grief. And it was really sad to witness that there wasn't anybody that could straddle both communities, that could bring a sense of community and be able to mediate the differences that the families wanted, the different ways the family wanted to go through the process of grieving for that child.
So you mean just being Pacific was not enough?
No, not being Pacific was enough. And there are some, I understand there are some really deep cultural protocols for both communities around something as difficult as grief. And a funeral is always complicated for any family. Forget about polycultural, just think about a Tongan family having a funeral. There are complexities. A Samoan family having a funeral, there are complexities. But when you add different communities coming around, the really big moments that occur in the life cycle, then what you see is if we don't have the skills to help mediate that type of conflict, then you see the sorts of distress escalates, and I think it put other young people at risk.
So at a national level, the blanket title of cultural competency as we knew it needs to change.
80s and 90s, it has to change. So polycultural capital is the new way that we have to look at it, because two-thirds of all our children are of mixed ethnicity. So it's very rare now to go and see a Tongan child at school. When we get called in for a school-related problem, we're going to see a child of mixed Pacific ethnicity. And also Balangi Pacific, so Tongan, Balangi, Samoan, Balangi, we have to address that, because then a European mother and a European family don't want to look, they don't look at the problems that a young person is going through the same lens, and that creates a space where conflict exists and conflict mediation, so that a young person can be safe and their siblings can be safe. That is a really complex task. It's become more complicated.
A prominent member of Bougainville Civil Society in Papua New Guinea has dressed down parents for not caring properly for their children. Helen Hakana of the Letiana Women's Development Agency, speaking at an International Children's Day event last week, said many parents dump their responsibilities for their children onto others. She told Don Wiseman, Bougainville parents have very large families, but they don't plan for the associated costs or prepare for expenses such as school fees.
It's our parental responsibilities to care for their children. School fees, education, children's health, children's food, the everyday needs of the child is a responsibility of parents. Because here in Bougainville, I see daily there are so many kids that are not going to school because parents cannot afford to pay for their school fees, because parents have other interests. They think of themselves only and they don't think of the future of their children. And there are some kids who go without food. There is so much food available here in the gardens in Bougainville. But there are some parents who do not care about feeding their children well. Good food is being sold at the market and the children are left to go hungry. Parents are not being responsible. Bougainville children have missed out a lot because we had the Bougainville conflict. And now there are opportunities for children to go to school. But parents are not taking their children to school. Now that we are at the end of the school year, only few children are getting through high school, grade 12, grade 10. The others have dropped out along the way because parents have not been responsible enough to encourage them to continue on with their education.
When you say that these parents, they have the resources, there's not a lot of work, is there? Is that the case for most of them?
There isn't a lot of jobs here available in Bougainville, but there is work on the land. We've got a lot of family plantations, coconut plantations, cocoa. There is so much marine resources, like they can catch fish and sell at the market for parents to get money to help pay for their children's school fees or clothing or medicine or whatever the kids need. But there are very few who are working on the land.
Historically, in Papua New Guinea, family sizes have been big. Is that still the case in 2018?
Yes, it is still the same. There are so many large families here. There are 7, 8, 9 or even 11 kids in a family. So parents cannot even afford to send most of them to school. There is always a choice between who goes to school. And the majority is always boys. Boys get the best preferences to go to school. But last week I attended the grade 10 and 11 graduation ceremony at Hutchena High School, and I was so happy that there are more girls than boys graduating in the school. So the numbers are changing. So like you are saying, there are so many large families in Bougainville and in Papua New Guinea, and parents cannot afford to pay for the needs of those children. But then we have the extended family businesses that we have, like extended families, we help support one another. This is going down the line as well. People are more thinking individually about themselves and about their own family. So this is a huge problem now in Papua New Guinea and in Bougainville.
So when you tell parents that they're not good parents, how are they reacting?
Some parents are saying, thank you so much for reminding me about my responsibility. But there are other parents that are saying, why are you saying that when you know pretty well that the times are hard, that we are finding it very, very difficult to support our children? And I say, but it is very important for us to plan for our children, you know, the number of kids that we should have, or to budget small amounts of money that we are getting from the market or from our coconut plantation. It's very important for each parent to do up a budget and not to be surprised or caught at the beginning of next year to pay school fees. That is what usually happens here.
And that's all we have time for in this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.